today in our studio the writer and journalist Mark Arax. He's the author of 4 books, one of them just out. It's called The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Alice.
There's a romance or bravado to your writing that makes it seem as if everything you're describing was almost predestined. And the best example of that comes in the prologue. So why don't you start by reading a part of that?
On a summer day in the San Joaquin Valley, 101 in the shade, I merge onto Highway 99 past downtown Fresno. I stick to the left lane and stay ahead of the pack. The big rig drivers are cranky two ways, and the farm workers in their last leg vans are half asleep. 99 is the deadliest highway in America. Deadly in the rush of harvest, deadly in the quiet of fog, deadly in the blur of Saturday nights when the field work is done and the beer drinking becomes a second humiliation. 20 miles outside Fresno, I cross the Kings, the river that irrigates more farmland than any other river here. The Kings is bone dry as usual. To find its flow, I'd have to go looking in 1,000 irrigation ditches in the fields beyond. There's a mountain range to my left and a mountain range to my right, and in between a plain flatter than Kansas where crop and sky meet. One of the most dramatic alterations of the Earth's surface in human history took place here. The hills that existed back in Yokut Indian days were flattened by a hunk of metal called the Fresno Scraper. Every river busting out of the Sierra was bent sideways, if not backward, by a bulwark of ditches, levees, canals, and dams. The farmer corralled the snowmelt and erased the valley, its desert and marsh. He leveled its hog wallows, denuded its salt brush, and killed the last of its mustang, antelope, and tule elk. He emptied the sky of millions of geese and drained the 800 square miles of Tulare Lake dry. He did this first in the name of wheat, then beef, milk, raisins, cotton, and nuts. Once he finished grabbing the flow of the 5 rivers that ran across the plain, he used his turbine pumps to seize the water beneath the ground. As he bled the aquifer dry, he called on government to bring him an even mightier river from afar. Down the great aqueduct, by freight of politics and gravity, came the excess waters of the Sacramento River. The farmer commanded the distant flow. The more water he took, the more crops he planted, and the more crops he planted, the more water he needed to plant more crops, and on 1 million acres of the valley floor, greater than the size of Rhode Island, are now covered in almond trees. I pity the outsider trying to make sense of it. My grandfather, a survivor of the Armenian Genocide, traveled 7,000 miles by ship and train in 1920 to find out if his uncle's exhortation, "The grapes here are the size of jade eggs," was true. My father, born in a vineyard outside Fresno, was a raisin grower before he became a bar owner. I grew up in the suburbs where our playgrounds were named after the pioneers of fruit, and irrigation canals shot through our neighborhoods to farms we did not know. For half my life, I never stopped to wonder how much was magic, how much was plunder.
And we find from your reporting that it's a bit of both. There's a lot of stories in your book about how farmers get water, how they sell it, how the big farmers drill deeper to access groundwater that other smaller farmers can't. You write, water isn't the equalizer that the state and federal water projects promised. Water is the means by which the valley has become one of the most unequal places on Earth. That's a pretty heady statement.
You know, one of the things I do at the valley isn't one place. It's not one valley. It's at least 3 valleys, if not 4. And there's an east side, there's a west side of Fresno, a west side of Kern, an east side that's the citrus belt, and then a center valley where the raisins and the grapes grow. And I think the center valley is the one that comes the closest to an agrarian ideal. And the distribution of water is more or less equal there. each of these places has a different relationship to water, and that relationship makes for a different place. So when you go to the east side and you see these communities that were built around water, you see the children of farm workers going to school with the children of farmers. That's one kind of place. Then you go to the west side where there's where the culture of water is really a culture of extraction, and the water is in the hands of a few. So if you go to Kern County, and we see the most extreme example of that in unequal distribution, if you go to Western Kern, you will find the Empire of Wonderful, which is owned by Stuart and Linda Resnick. They are the farmers who live in Beverly Hills and then come up and over the mountain and farm the valley. And you also see that in Corcoran, where the Boswells control 15% of the Kings River. That's an ungodly amount of water. How did they own that? Well, if you trace these things back, you'll find that, one, they bought the rights in these early canal companies that were diverting those rivers. And so by buying those rights, they were able to divert that water and control it, and literally own it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the word control, because the other example is the Resnick's Wonderful Company and how they manipulated the system to get access to a big chunk of the Kern Water Bank. And you have a great scene in your book where you kind of describe sort of the nuttiness of water in California, where they actually can use some of that water to sell back to the state.
So the problem with farming in Western Kern is there's really no groundwater to speak of. So much farming here in the valley is dependent on the rivers first, and then once the river flow, you know, has problems, then you go into the earth and you pump groundwater. Western Kern doesn't have that. So for Resnick to grow, he had to acquire this Kern water bank, and he did it in a backroom deal in Monterey, and it's still very controversial today. So in the wet years of 2005 and 2006, Resnick had more water than even his trees could drink. So much water came down the aqueduct that he could afford to sell some of the surplus from the water bank. These weren't farm-to-city transfers. This was public water he was selling back to the state through a program called the Environmental Water Account. Its purpose on paper struck a noble note. With water marketing now in vogue, farmers were encouraged to sell surplus water back to the state to help endangered fish in the Delta. Never mind that these same fish were being imperiled by state pumps working overtime to satisfy the demands of farmers. This program allowed Resnick to masquerade as an environmentalist while raiding California's ecological kitty. He was paying the state anywhere from $28 to $86 an acre foot for the water he deposited in the bank. He was then selling this water back to the state and the fish for $200 an acre foot. The trade not only generated $38 million in profits for Resnick, he was able to offer some of the cheap surplus water to independent nut growers as an inducement to process their almonds and pistachios with him. The water bank had become an instrument to further his monopoly.
Amazing. And that took place when before the last huge drought. And there's some great scenes in with your reporting where you're tracking down people, knocking on doors. At one point, I remember you find Stuart Resnick at an event in Visalia where you're not invited, actually. And he looks at you with that kind of quizzical indifference that the really wealthy give to people who aren't forwarding their interest. And I wonder what it's like for you as a son of the San Joaquin Valley to confront, if you will, the issues and people of Big Ag.
Several years before, Resnick had invited me into his mansion after reading The King of California and telling me that he thought that I should write a book about him. And I wasn't sure what to call it, The Second King of California. So we had this long interview, and then he got busy and I got busy, and we it never happened. So as I'm starting the Dremplan, I'm trying to figure out what he's up to, he doesn't want to meet. So I end up tracking him down to this pistachio conference in Visalia. I wasn't invited, but they had these pistachio green annual reports, thick ones. And I grabbed one from a trash can, dusted it off. There was a little coffee stain on it, actually, and walked in like I was invited. And then after his wife had spoken, he had spoken, and the session was finished, I went and wanted to talk to him about this secret pipeline.
That he was using during the drought.
That he was using during the drought to keep his trees alive.
And essentially he was piping water from two counties over.
That's right, that's right. Pumping water out of the ground in a place where the land was sinking because of so much pumping. And then he had teamed up with another billionaire, and they used canals and a pipeline to then send that water to Kern County and Resnick's fields. And he looked at me, and obviously he didn't recognize me from years before, and then I tried to explain who I was, and he just kind of, his publicist came.
His people.
His people came, saw that the boss needed help, needed rescuing, and she whisked him out of there, and off he went. Of course, later in the book, you see that I do track him down. In fact, he calls me and wants to meet, and that's the epilogue of the book.
And yet he still evades that question.
Yes.
Of the pipeline. But what is it like for you to confront these issues and these people, having grown up here, having a very interesting history here? Your family's been here for decades, farm family at first.
You know, this is a place not only puzzling to me, but it's a mystery to almost all of us who live here. It's a place that doesn't want to confront its history. And the farmers, you know, their reflex is to hide. I remember when I was doing The King of California, one of the huge farmers in the Tulare Lake Basin, the Salyer family, Fred Salyer told me that he was quite happy to die with his history on his pillow. I have no trepidation walking up to billionaires and asking them questions. And ultimately, what I try to tell them is, listen, I want to tell your story. And I want to tell it with you involved. And so that's how the door opens.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm talking to writer Mark Arax about his new book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. You write an awful lot about the sinking of the land or subsidence due to deep pumps sucking up water from the aquifer. There's a place called Red Top in Madera where you take us. The rate of subsidence there is more than any other place in the world. Tell us a little bit about Red Top.
What I try to do in this book is I try to bring three things to bear. One is the history of this place, and I tell that through these characters, from Father Sarah to John Sutter to Henry Miller to Isaac Friedlander, the 6'7", you know, wheat king. And then I weave that in, that history, with the reporting on the land and the talking to people, and then my own story, my own family story. And so when I go to Red Top, I don't just see Red Top as a place that's sinking. I see it as a place where I did time. I mean, I was in high school with a crew of my friends. We were all football players. We went out to Red Top to weed the sugar beet fields, you know, a pretty miserable job. And so as I'm documenting this subsidence, I'm also telling the story of that summer in 1976, 75, and of confronting these weeder geese. It's kind of funny. I knew this dirt when it was sugar beets. This is where my high school buddies and I took jobs one summer with a company called Sun Fruit Limited, which seemed more apropos of a grower of plums and peaches, not sugar beets and cotton. We were paid the minimum wage to wield long-handled hoes and trudge up and down the quarter-mile rows of beets, looking for weeds. We were a poor excuse for farm workers, though we didn't know it yet. The crew boss let us go at our own pace for a week or two, perhaps thinking we would find our way to usefulness after a suitable period of breaking in. Our third week there, he drove up and unloaded from the back of his truck a bunch of cages holding some kind of species of bird that he let out on the rows next to ours. "Weeder geese," he announced. "A whole battalion of them." I never knew such a bird existed. We were in decent enough shape for 17-year-old boys, most of us training for our senior year of football. The plan was to work the fields for a month or two and then quit in late August when double-day practices began. What none of us had factored in was the arrival of the geese. They'd been bred with a streak of mean and an appetite for weeds that could not be quenched. That first day, they laid down an immediate challenge. We could either follow their lead or be put to shame by it. We stopped talking, leaned forward into the earth, and locked onto each of our rows. It was 105 in the sun, and the thick coating of sulfur that dusted the waist-high beets turned into a vapor that made everything smell more rotten than it was. That first week, up against the birds, was a blur. This wasn't mowing and edging the front yard and hula-hoeing the courtyard. Field labor took a grit that suburbia had not conditioned us for. Honking and hissing, the geese had no quit. Day after day, our defeat became a mockery. Sulfured faces, dripping lines of sweat, we began to plot against the birds. Taking them on at close range was out of the question. They were the perfect size to go right after our privates. Since I played quarterback, the long-distance assault was led by me. The heavy soil of Red Top produced a high-quality dirt clod. One by one, we started picking off the birds. Not enough to kill or maim them, but enough to let them know that they couldn't get ahead of us without feeling it. When our 6 weeks of labor was finished and we walked off the sugar beet fields and onto the gridiron at Bullard High, we'd been made better by the birds, or so we thought. Then a 5-5 season made us question how we'd spent our summer and more. In all my drives through the fields in the years that followed, I don't think I ever saw another crew of weeder geese. With the rise of Monsanto's Roundup, I believe the birds finally came to understand the agony of defeat. In the move from row crops to permanent crops, the geese were the first workers to be idled.
It's kind of a metaphor for the way agriculture in the valley has evolved, right?
Yeah.
The bigger, the better, the stronger, the more likely that you'll succeed.
That bending of water that began with the gold rush, okay? Because the mining of gold was really the mining of water. So when you see how we then turned the mountain into these flumes, and those flumes took the rivers, and then the flumes connected to these hydraulic hoses, which was the beginning of hydraulic engineering. That bending then became a bending of the rivers when the gold rush ended, and the next boom was the fields of the Central Valley. That bending that took place in the mountain became a culture that was then transplanted down into the valley floor.
So your book, it's a mixture of investigative reporting, history, memoir, even warning, forewarning. How do you, as a reporter, organize this wealth of research? Do you go chapter by chapter, or did you finish all of the reporting before you started writing the book?
First of all, you have to have a huge capacity to fool yourself, because at the outset, you would never tell yourself that this is going to take 6 years. So you tell yourself it's going to take 2 years. And then you go out with a tape recorder and notebook, fill them up, transcribe. You know, it's wonderful to have tapes, you know, because you can really hear things again. But then you have to transcribe those tapes. And sometimes you transcribe so many that you get carpal tunnel syndrome. You say, well, this is going to take me a little bit longer. And so you go a little deeper. And you may do a little writing along the way, and the transcribing, in a way, becomes some writing. And you fool yourself again, telling yourself, well, I'm not really writing. Because, you know, when you're really writing, it's like, oh, gosh, I'm really writing. So you fool yourself along the way. And some of the best writing you do is when you're transcribing those tapes, and then you start, you're freed up, and you start doing some riffs. You outline the book. I outline the book. That outline, when I look back on it, I do it all in pen and paper. You find that maybe 80% of it holds, but then that other 20%, those are the surprises where the reporting takes you in a place you never thought, and the storytelling, the writing takes you to places you never thought.
Okay, now I'm dying to ask. Tell me one of those surprises.
I found a field man who gave me a tip. And that tip led to this secret pipeline. And that secret pipeline then led back to not only one billionaire, Resnick, but a second billionaire, a guy named Vidovich. So that was a surprise. There's so many surprises along the way. And then the writing is a surprise. I never thought that, as a kind of metaphor, would be our last ranch across the San Joaquin River. And yet that pulls at the narrative throughout. And the book ends on that last ranch, where had my father stayed there, our whole lives might have been different. So this is a personal book in a lot of ways. But then there's the reportage and then the history telling. Even in the history telling sections, you know, when I'm dealing with the natives, the Yokuts and all the other natives, and I come across this great chief of the tribe that lived in Yosemite, the Awanachi. Their leader was a man named Tenaya. And there's a great scene where he is being herded off his land, and he gives this curse of all curses to the white man. And it brings tears to your eyes. And I never heard about Tenaya. We were never taught about Tenaya. And yet I went to Tenaya Junior High School. We were dumb to our history. I was dumb to our history. There were irrigation canals that ran through our neighborhoods. Who knew where they were going? Who knew why they were going to where they were going? All I knew is my grandmother would tell me, do not go up that embankment because you will slip and fall in the water and no one will come to recover your body. And I asked her why. She said, because the flow of the valley means more than the body of one silly boy.
That is incredible. That's a forewarning. And it's like many of the forewarnings in this book. You've got a professor's call a good century ago for the state to regulate groundwater. There's that geologist Joe Poland back in the 70s who stands next to a telephone pole that marks subsidence, and it keeps getting lower. The ground is sinking more and more. There's Charlie Brannan at the USDA who feared the Central Valley Project would turn the San Joaquin Valley into a water-guzzling monster. So you've got all these warnings, but I'm wondering, is history teaching us anything?
At the end of the book, I have this late night visit from all the characters in this book, you know, from Father Sarah to Muir to Henry Miller to J.G. Boswell. And it's where I'm trying to reckon with that history. And you can see from the 1920s to today, not much has changed. Back in the 20s, the farmers in the valley had used up their rivers. Those were all, you know, the flow of those rivers was all allocated. Then in 1920, the turbine pump was invented and allowed them to go deeper in the earth. And they did, and the ground was sinking back then. And they couldn't pump anymore. The electrical costs got such and they couldn't go down any deeper. That was the cry for steal us a river. And they stole this part of the flow of the Sacramento, shipped it here, and then took the flow of the San Joaquin and shipped it south. So here I am in the midst of the 2015 drought, and the same cry of Dust Bowl is happening, and the same cry of steal us another river is happening. Damn the San Joaquin once more. It's already been dammed 6 or 7 times in its upper reaches, once down below. There's no more water to give to a dam. So you can see that in 100 years, just in that time period, nothing had changed.
So what does this mean for the future of California? What does all this reporting tell you about what's going to happen in the next century?
Just like we overdeveloped suburbia, we've overdeveloped the farm belt. We started with primo land, and then we went to marginal land, and now we're farming poor land. And we're doing that because we've made the rivers and the groundwater reach those places. But the system that we built to temper the tantrums of drought and flood, that system is cracking, and something has to give. We're farming 6 million acres in the San Joaquin Valley, and when the groundwater regulations, the new law takes effect, and all of it shakes out, I think we're going to be farming 4 million acres. 2 million acres will go back to fallowed land, and some of the water saved will go back into the rivers for the environment, and some of it will go to other farmers who are farming better land.
But that won't take effect for a couple decades, right?
It'll be at least 15 more years, but those decisions are already happening now. And it'll be painful. There'll be lots of lawsuits. Certainly the book looks at how those things played out in the past. And they were very ugly, and they pitted farmer and farmer and farmer against city folk, and that will probably happen again. What I'm hoping is that smaller, smarter ag is able to sustain itself, and that small and medium-sized farmers will still have a role. Right now, we're seeing hedge funds and pension funds and retirement funds from all over the world and the country coming here and investing in farmland. One of the more, I think, fascinating encounters in this book is at the end, when I'm about finished with all my travels and I find this farmer in Madera, and I call him the Oracle because that's how he's served. He's been an oracle for me for years. And we go on the land and he shows me these places that have been planted in almonds and pistachios that should have never been farmed. And he says those will be the first places where the farm will go fallow. And he talks about the craziness of the system and the craziness of the banking policies and all of this kind of madness that has led to this overdevelopment of the farm belt. It's quite a moving scene.
Well, that's probably a good place to end.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in, Mark.
Thank you, Alice.
And we should note that Mark Arax will be reading from his new book, The Dreamt Land, this Friday, May 17th at 7 p.m. at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District.